Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi there, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology and faculty associate in law and public affairs.
You know, over the past few years, there's been a lot of discussion about a series of key issues about what's going on in the United States. Some of this discussion has revolved around the economy and the kinds of struggles that middle and working class Americans have been facing as a result of changes in industry and the flight of jobs and everything from the loss of the American dream to the actual condition, physical and emotional condition through which many Americans live their life. And a lot of this came together in the election when there seemed to be shifts in the electorate toward President Trump based on these issues. And we've had a whole other set of important discussions about health, the health of Americans and how health care is provided, the health literally of citizens, from questions of obesity to drug use and to some of the problems that we have been facing as a nation. And unfortunately, these are two areas that are often disconnected in our discussion. And today we have a wonderful opportunity to speak with someone who has been trying to bring these two realms together and actually move us forward, I think, in substantive understanding of what's wrong and how things can get better. So we are really honored to have with us Professor Ann Case. She's the Alexander Stewart 1886 Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University. She's the director of the Research Program in Development Studies. She's written a great deal on health over the life course. She was awarded the Kenneth Arrow Prize in Health Economics from the International Health Economics Association for her work looking at economic and health status as it relates to childhood. And she has won many other prizes. She is also in the advisory council of the NIH, National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, and a research associate at NBER, and she's published a series of papers on economics and health that have really captured a lot of public attention in recent years. So we're really excited to have her. Ann, welcome to our show.
Thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
Maybe you can just start by telling our listeners a little bit more about what you have been finding about the mortality rate for middle-aged, non-Hispanic whites, and what the relationship is that you've been looking at with socioeconomic status.
Sure. So a couple of years ago, my co-author Angus Deaton and I started looking at health in middle age, and we stumbled on something that seemed to have been going under the radar, which is that unlike the countries in Europe that we think of as good comparison countries, rich countries like France or Germany and other English-speaking countries like Canada or Australia or the UK, what we found was that among white non-Hispanics in middle age, mortality rates stopped falling and actually started to rise. This comes on the heels of a century in which mortality rates fell in middle age for whites from, say, 1,400 per 100,000 in 1900, down to 400 per 100,000 in year 2000. So this dramatic decline in mortality that we came to expect. And then suddenly it seemed to have come to an abrupt halt. And as we dug deeper,
When did that reversal happen?
The late 1990s. Mm-hmm. So about, actually, to pinpoint it, 1998 was mm-hmm. like the last year in which mortality rates fell for whites aged 45 to 54, say. And we thought it originally, well, what is this? Is this heart disease or cancer, since those are big killers in middle age? And no, rates had actually continued falling for those, although they will reappear as part of the story. But what we found was instead mortality rates started to increase for drug mortality, for suicide, and for alcohol-related liver diseases. So we thought about those as all being of a piece. We think of those as either being quick suicide with a gun or slow suicide using drugs and alcohol. And so that was sort of the first piece, which actually got quite a lot of attention. And from that point till now, when we've now released a second piece with Brookings, we've been at work trying to figure out what the heck is going on here. Why has this happened?
So these are, I mean, these are mechanisms. I mean, speaking as a neuroscientist, since that's my principal discipline, in some sense, these are disciplines of this era, disorders that originate in the brain, in the sense that addiction has mechanisms that are in the brain. Suicide is obviously something that is triggered by brain mechanisms, as opposed to, say, lung cancer.
Yeah.
Or skin cancer. These are those would be causes that do not arise. So there's something there that, depending on your discipline, you might put it a different way. But in some very real way, they're either neuropsychiatric or mental.
Although we think of, for example, if you died of lung cancer, it's probably because you were a smoker, right? Which is also related
True.
To addiction.
Yeah. Again, with the brain mechanism.
Right.
Right.
Or when we think about the stunning increase in obesity in the U.S., we think that in the end of the day, we might think about obesity the way we think about drug overdose or alcohol-related deaths, which is people trying to soothe the beast, right? So you
yeah.
might soothe it with food, you might soothe it with alcohol, you might soothe it with drugs.
That feels a little bit more ambiguous because it depends on the type and amount of food that's available. And so there's a mixture of causation that comes from inside and also comes from supply. One can make rats fat by giving them certain kinds of food in their diet.
True enough, and I don't want to throw us from the course.
No, but
here,
I think your main story is very compelling, and it's a unified story. I didn't mean to derail you from your principal story.
So as we dug deeper, what we're finding is that if you look at other things that are happening to whites in middle age, I should back up here. The people who are suffering here are people who did not go to college, mm-hmm. people with less than a BA. And they're getting hammered. People with a college degree or more, there has been a slight rise in suicide and a slight rise in drug overdose, but it's dwarfed by what's happening to working class whites.
And so, what accounts for that? I mean, what do you think is going on that is causing this increase in that subset right now?
Part of what's happening is that we have had an opioid epidemic in the U.S. That's a prescription opioid epidemic.
Okay.
And that's hammered the white community more than it has the black community. Why that happened? Well, the why is partly from supply, which is that Purdue Pharmaceutical got acceptance from the FDA to actually release heroin in a pill with an FDA label on it and sent out a marketing force around the U.S.
When was this?
1996
wow.
And on
huh.
from there. So with 2,000 marketers out there, Purdue has actually earned now $31 billion and counting from OxyContin. But in the end of the day, we think of that as an accelerant to what was already going on because we can date this back as far as we can actually take death records with education attached to them, which is the early 1990s.
And so just the opioid, but when you say it's hit whites, that's because for African Americans, they've had a different route for being hit by opioids, right? Heroin. And so that's another route that's been hitting that community.
Although there was a terrible heroin epidemic, it subsided. And then this prescription opioid epidemic mm-hmm. came online. And African American deaths from drug and alcohol related deaths are actually lower than they are for whites in middle age and have been since the early 2000s.
I see. Okay. So the new player in the scene is?
Has been prescription opioids.
Got it. Okay.
But there are now efforts to rein in prescription opioids. Most states have become compliant with having a register where you can actually keep the opioids somewhat under control. But as the opioids then have left the scene, very cheap heroin coming in from Mexico that's quite pure. People tell me it's cheaper than what in my generation we would have called pot. I guess you call it weed now. Cheaper than weed. And you don't have to inject it. You can snort it or you can smoke it. You don't have to actually use a needle. So as people have stopped having access to prescription opioids, the movement has been to this very cheap heroin and most recently to fentanyl.
And what about methamphetamine? So a different category of drugs that's debilitating.
It is debilitating, and they have not been as big a killer as either the big increases have been in prescription opioids, heroin, and fentanyl.
And this is overdoses? Is that the route?
Deaths from overdose, uh-huh. from these, accidental overdose.
Okay, all right.
Now, one of the reasons it didn't hit the African-American community, because that became quite an issue, was, one, there's a small literature now that when an African-American presents with pain, they're significantly less likely at the same level of reported pain to be prescribed opioids. And two, that drugstores in the centers of cities don't want to stock opioids because it makes them a target. Now, in the end of the day, though, what we think was that the opioids were there, so that just helped to create a perfect storm, but that these deaths from suicide, from drug overdose, from alcohol had started increasing before the opioids actually entered the scene.
And so part of what you're saying, or at least suggesting, is this is an economic story. So this is the story everyone's familiar with now of the kind of white working class suffering since the 1970s as the economy changed. And you're arguing that this has had numerous health effects.
That's right. We think that there are all of these dysfunctions that we can now measure, and they all seem to be moving in tandem, getting worse with every successive birth cohort. Hmm. So, for example, if you don't have the chance to get a good job, your girlfriend doesn't want to marry you. Now, she may let you move in, so cohabitation is way up. But unlike in Europe, where cohabitations tend to be very stable, in the U.S. they tend to be quite fragile. So you might be out on your butt because either she can't afford to take care of you and the child you've had with her. And so there tends to be repartnering, and that's become socially acceptable in a way it wasn't a generation ago. So you don't have a stable marriage to fall back on. Religions have changed so that people have moved away from the legacy churches toward churches that sort of emphasize seeking or emphasize the individual. And those also don't necessarily provide you with the sort of support that a legacy church might have provided in an earlier generation. And you have a hard time finding a job that has a ladder up. So that jobs with on-the-job training, jobs where you could expect a union job where you might expect that with seniority you would be paid more, those jobs have gone away, and there's very little sign they're coming back.
And do the effects matter if people are living in rural areas or suburban areas or more urban areas?
That's a really good question. The press has often made this out to be a story about rural America, right. And certainly it is. But these deaths of despair, suicide, drug, alcohol-related deaths, are rising at every level of urbanization. So they're highest still in the center cities, but the micropolitan areas, MSAs, statistical areas of all sizes, and rural areas have all seen this increase in deaths.
Now, there's a dialogue in response to your PNAS paper that you and Deaton had in 2015. It obviously triggered a fairly large response. And one of the responses was this comment by Stephen Edward Snyder, who is one of several people who wrote into PNAS to talk about this. And he said that there was, in fact, a stronger effect in rural areas. So you're saying that it's across all domains. But he seems to think that per capita, his analysis of, I guess, the Centers for Disease Control, CDC data, suggests that there's an especially strong effect in rural areas. So does that seem consistent with what you...
Not for deaths of despair. Uh-huh. They've risen everywhere in parallel. However, if you look at all-cause mortality rates, yeah. right, since these are a large and growing part of mortality in middle age, but cancer deaths and heart disease deaths are still big killers in middle age. And a lot of what drives all-cause mortality is going to depend on what happens to those two killers. So in areas where smoking rates didn't come down, cancer rates continue to rise. And that's more likely possibly in rural areas than in urban areas.
So here's an alternate explanation that isn't necessarily in contradiction to what you're saying, but just to look at it another way. You're looking at upstream causes that might be the source of these problems. But what about issues like, what about preventive health care? These are people who, being less educated, might be less likely to get preventive health care. Do you see that as being a major cause? Rural communities, even urban communities, but people who don't have that much education, not seeking out advice. If you have an open, you know, routine screening where a physician says, do you have a drink in the morning to get your eyes open? Stuff like that. I mean, there's just a lot of routine screening that comes with being insured, comes with having medical care. How do you see that fitting in?
That's a good question. Obviously, on death records, we don't know whether or not someone was insured, mm-hmm. right? So it's a little hard to back that out.
Right. You've got your concrete data that you analyze.
Yeah.
So I'm asking sort of like...
Yeah. What do you think upstream
happened? I want to hear you think about that.
It's interesting. The kinds of deaths that we're talking about here, suicide, drug overdose, alcohol, are ones that the medical community has a really heck of a time trying to deal with,
mm-hmm.
right? We don't know how to handle addiction well, right? So if anything, medical care, we think, may have iatrogenically made this problem worse by handing out opioids to people who only have so many. If you're on Medicaid and the doctor only has so many billable minutes, he may just throw some opioids at you, you're out the door, and they're on to their next person. Right. So we think actually that access to medical care may have made some of these problems, especially the opioid problem, worse, not better.
I see. So when you say despair, so this all fits together as self-medication. Something's wrong and you're looking for a way to make things better, and you look around you to see what's available. And one of the things that's around you is OxyContin.
Yes. Hmm. Yeah. I think that might be. Now, when we found that all-cause mortality started rising in the late 90s, and we saw that these causes were increasing quite dramatically, these deaths of despair, what we needed to take a step back to find was that none of this would have come to light if we had continued to make as great progress on heart disease mortality as we had been making. But we stopped a heart disease mortality, which was falling quite nicely from 1970 through to the late 1990s, first started to slow down, and then progress flatlined, unlike what happened in Europe, where progress continues on heart disease. So it was the case that until the late 90s, our progress on heart disease was masking the fact that we were seeing these increases in deaths of despair. So once the heart disease flatlined, that allowed these deaths of despair to actually cause all-cause mortality to go up.
How'd you come up with the term death of despair?
It's a shorthand for us rather than having to spin off all three of those things at once. But it does seem like that if you kill yourself, or one way or the other, with drugs, with alcohol, or with a gun, or that seems like an act of desperation to us. It doesn't seem like the kind of thing that one would do if one thought that the future looked bright.
So that's important. I mean, obviously, direct suicide is clear. Yeah. But drug addiction, I assume some people will ask, how do you kind of know if it's intentional or it's just addiction that leads to a bad outcome, which would be important to why this is happening.
But one way to think about that is that there is pretty good evidence that addiction has a heritable component. In other words, that if one person in a family has substance abuse problems, then there is a higher likelihood that someone else will as well. And there's reasonably good evidence that that has a genetic component. So it feels like what drug you take depends on what's available. So if you're in the middle of Russia, maybe alcohol is the thing you get. If you're in the middle of Nebraska, the thing you can get is a nice pill provided by Purdue Pharmaceutical of OxyContin. And so the exact thing that you get available, right? So the point being that drug addiction, if we think about it as what a behavioral scientist might call allostatic or homeostatic, where you want to get to a place where things feel okay, and what it takes to feel okay is to take a drug. Mm-hmm. And some people have more tendency than others to need that in order to feel okay. Others don't. And, you can see this. It's like the Tennessee Williams thing where some families seem to have to be very substance-y.
Yeah.
And then other families just aren't very substance-y at all. And so we have this in us. And so the despair explanation fits with the idea that there's just something that in this demographic has not been feeling right for 20 years.
Has not been feeling right. The 1972 was the high point of wages for working class Americans. So from that point forward, job opportunities started to decline. And we think that that has, we think at the end of the day that the cancer in the system is going to be something that happened in the labor market for these people. If you turn to some conservative commentators, say Charles Murray, he would just say there's been this loss of virtue, right? That people have lost their industriousness. Mm-hmm. But I think
it sounds like what they've lost is their wages.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that I have a lot of respect for Charles Murray, but I think that in the end of the day, it's much easier to maintain your virtue if you have a job.
Yeah, because poor people work. I mean, the thing is, when people say, oh, well, you don't have the virtue, look, you don't have money, you must not be virtuous. But on the other hand, people in working class situations, they have to hunt pretty hard to get a living. So I wanted to, you said a high point for wages in America in 1972.
For working class.
What's the case in other Western countries? Is the pattern the same in France, Germany, other countries?
That's a good question, and that's on our research agenda.
Yeah, because one would want to look for the correlation to see whether it's a peculiarly American disease problem or whether it's something that one could separate by country.
It's complicated by the fact that Western Europe has a much better social safety net than the U.S. has. Right. And universal health care. And I don't generally go for cultural explanations, but the U.S. also has inculcated in people the sense that you're an individual and individuals take care of themselves. And I take care of me and my family and you take care of you and your family. And we like it that way. Thank you very much. And not that we bond together and see ourselves through difficult times. For example, in Spain during the Great Recession, and Spain was as hard hit as almost any other country, mortality rates fell in every demographic. Now, so somehow they kept body and soul together in a way that we have not been able to in this group. And I think partly it is because people think, if I don't make it, I'm a failure, and I don't want to be a burden on those around me, and I'm out of here.
And so this all must have huge consequences on childhood in these communities. If you have parents who are, you know, living in these conditions, I assume it starts to replicate itself on the health of the kid.
That's one of the next steps. This is a very large research agenda, mm-hmm. so it's going to take place in steps. But thinking about what happens to children, it's more likely than not that a white woman without a college degree will now have at least one child out of wedlock. Now, that child may know two or three fathers before they leave home. What happens to those kids? And what happens to them given that many of them are being raised in communities where industry pulled out, and when industry pulled out, the tax base imploded, and the local schools aren't very good anymore. So it may not just be what you think about hope for yourself. It may be about what you think about hope for your children that might drive things south.
This is so reminiscent. I wonder if within the data or in studies that have been done prior to your work, whether one can connect dots between this category of explanation, this tone of explanation in what we'd call, you know, say, white blue-collar decay or maybe rural decay. I mean, I'm a little bit stuck on that a little bit. I don't want to get locked into it too much. But now I'm thinking back to the 60s and 70s and urban decay. Mm-hmm. So to what extent could one say that there are parallel events happening in white blue-collar communities that might have happened with urban black Americans at that time? Because things you're saying sound a lot like what one has heard about, you know, like back in the Moynihan Report and so on.
Yes, absolutely. I think there might be real parallels there. One of the things that we found in this most recent paper that just came out in Brookings, which surprised me, is that if you look at mortality rates for blacks and whites with a high school degree or less, black and white mortality rates have converged. So that's happened both because black mortality rates have fallen and white mortality rates have risen, so that there's very little daylight now. Five-year age group by five-year age group, take people 25 to 29 or 30 to 34 or so on. So it looks like if we want to look at these problems, we may want to be looking at them really based on class rather than on race going forward.
Did Obama, do you know if the Affordable Care Act had any impact?
It's way too early to know.
Too early to know.
Yeah.
It has the feeling of something that could help.
Yeah. And like, I hate to name drop, but the question you asked about the black community 30 years ago is exactly what President Obama asked us in the Oval Office back 18 months ago or so.
Great question.
Excellent. Well, you know.
Excellent question.
Great, great. This whole room, that's good. That's heartening.
And a pro, let me just follow up. So Medicaid, you have a better measure. Yeah. Has that made an effect? Not recently, but
over time,
since the 60s.
What we see in terms of these deaths of despair is just a slow, gradual increase.
Right.
It's hard to see that things got any better during the go-go years of the 90s, and it's hard to see that things took any marked step up during the Great Recession. It's just been an increase that's slowly been building over time.
So it's not clear there's policies that have improved this, at least the policies we've had.
Not the policies that we've had.
Yeah, but these are often communities that don't necessarily have voters who are interested in voting for policies that increase the social safety net.
Because, I think that what we need actually are it's much better mental health facilities.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that we know necessarily how to treat addictions, but we certainly aren't doing ourselves any favor by not providing those services.
Right. This all reminds me, to take it towards the pop cultural level, it all reminds me of this Saturday Night Live sketch called Black Jeopardy. Have you seen this?
No, I don't know this.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a television watcher, but there's this sketch in which Tom Hanks plays a Trump supporter. He's on a game show with African Americans, and it turns out that they have a lot in common. Their cultural attitudes down the line are quite similar to one another. And it's a sketch that's meant to be comic, but it actually shows some deep commonality between Black Americans, urban Black Americans, and white working class Americans. And it's interesting, you know, feeling left out of power, feeling oppressed, not having much say in your future. And there's just that feeling that's captured. It's meant to be a joke, but it actually captures a lot of the things that you're talking about.
Were you surprised by the response that all of this work has received outside of academia?
We had thought it would touch a nerve, but we had no idea it was going to become central. Every political candidate in 2016 had to talk about this issue. It became a question that was asked during the Democratic presidential debate, for example. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of email from people who want to tell us their stories, which are really compelling. And I was surprised by just how large the response was.
That's interesting that it hit a nerve on both. It struck a chord with both sides. That's interesting, right? Because it suggests the possibility of movement of mental health as a priority that could actually move forward if there are people on both sides of the aisle who are interested in this.
I would hope so.
Well, obviously when you read this and all your work, you think then of the Hillbilly Elegy book, which took off and also captivated people, also looking at the psychological dysfunction or despair in these communities with a different kind of angle, though. Mm. I mean, you seem to be offering a different take, really emphasizing not having economic well-being is going to lead to the sorts of problems rather than some more cultural explanation to what's going on in these communities.
I tend to not go for cultural explanations if there are other explanations.
Yeah.
And I would think that if we need to figure out how we're going to have people who either don't choose to go to college, who don't want to go to college, who don't have the wherewithal, what we're going to do to help them participate in the 21st century economy. And I don't think that the K-12 program we have on offer is giving people the skills they're going to need if they're going to actually participate in a meaningful way in the U.S. So that's a political choice that we have to make.
Well, it used to be that skills that could serve everyone, even if they didn't have that much education, might involve operating machinery, manufacturing, being a driver, working in retail. But these are all job categories that are being hit pretty hard by the advent of technology
That's right.
and automation. And so to some extent, now we're in the domain of talking about remaking what it is to be an American who can get by and be working class. And maybe being working class might involve rudimentary abilities to code, right? I mean, just, you know, you don't have to be a great coder, but you just have to be able to do something with code in order to get your work done, things like that.
We definitely need to be thinking outside the box, for example, then when we're thinking about what kind of skills we're going to actually give students in high schools.
Right.
Or
as
vocational training following high school.
Right. Because if you can't be a truck driver anymore, then you got to do something, and ideally not involving OxyContin.
So the German model may be something that we should look at much more seriously of apprenticeships, right, where you actually in high school start to get the training that you would need to become part of a firm, and the firm picks you up right out of high school and puts you on a career path, right? And it's not going to be a career path that's going to lead you to be Steve Jobs, but it's going to probably give you enough of what you need in terms of income, status, to help you, you know, make a good life for yourself.
But that's pretty stratifying. When I was once a visiting research scientist in Germany, and the people who are educated scientists knew English. I could talk with them. They seemed pretty worldly. And then I'd attempt to talk to guys in the machine shop. And they, you know, if we wanted to work together, they had been sent down another track that did not involve learning English. And they seemed to be, you know, there was something that seemed quite stratified about that, which doesn't seem to fit well with what Americans believe themselves to be.
That's a good question. I'm not sure that I would agree with that. I think that it's not clear to me that the, you know, the people who are cleaning our buildings, right, they're not going to be talking to any of our French visitors in French, right? So there may be a lot of that already in place in the U.S.
I see.
I think the U.S. doesn't want to think about class. The U.S. wants to pretend that we're a classless society.
What I meant was that the belief of Americans is that people are mobile across classes, and so an explicit move in this direction might have to be approached kind of carefully.
There's this great book that you may have seen with a quite incendiary title called White Trash. Mm-hmm. And the history is set out and tells a pretty compelling story that from the get-go, America was a place where there were disposable white people. Right, that's been true throughout the time that we've been in North America, and that we pretend that we are a classless society and anyone can grow up to be president, and we don't actually put people on the same starting line, and we haven't for a very, very long time. And if we can offer people a chance, I think everyone should have a chance to go to college if they want to. But not everybody wants to. Not everybody would choose that path. And I think we just have to try to see what kinds of paths we can offer people that can give them a good job.
I mean, it seems to be that's a thread of a lot of the discussions, both your research and why it took off, a book like Hillbilly Elegy or the book White Trash, the discussions of the 2016 election and the groups of voters who flipped is some rediscovery of class and or discovery of class for many people and trying to understand what that actually means. And here you have very concrete health effects from physical to psychological that are unfolding for an economic segment of white America, which is very tangible proof that something is there that contradicts that myth in American life.
I mean, you've heard this before, that the only slur that's still politically acceptable in some circles is to call somebody a redneck, right? I mean, that's just crazy that is still considered acceptable. But that's the group, I think, that went out and voted and pulled the lever for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything I have to ask now that we're on to President Trump? So he appealed to some of the voters who are in the communities you are researching. Have you seen anything so far coming out of Washington since January that would do anything to address some of the problems you have found?
Not to date. I think that pulling back on the Affordable Care Act would be a huge mistake.
Because it's a route towards mental health services, for example.
It is, although apparently those are not working particularly well. It's very hard to get health care professionals who – mental health care professionals who want to go out into the middle of the country and provide services. And it's also very expensive, right? This tends to be a one-on-one that takes some time.
Well, while we're on the subject of what the federal government could do, just – this is a little bit of a different direction. We just had a march in science nationwide, and I went to the one here in Princeton. I want to back up a little bit and ask about the data sources that you used to do your analysis. Mm. Who gathered that data, and
So all of these data are publicly available. In fact, we're in the process of putting together a very long data appendix for our Brookings paper that will allow anyone to pull all of these data and either run what we ran or try something else. So we have 30 million death records that come from the National Vital Statistics. We applied for and received permission to use county-level identifiers on those. There are extremely fine health surveys that are run annually. There's the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, which interviews about 400,000 people a year. There's the National Health Interview Survey, which interviews maybe 150,000 people a year. And when you stack those up year by year by year, you can begin to have a picture on people's mental health, on people's inability to go about their daily business. We also use the current population surveys, which allows us to look at what's been happening to marriage rates, the fraction of people who have never married, the fraction of people who are currently not married, what their wages look like, whether or not they're in the labor force. And what we want to be able to do that we haven't yet, but in the next tranche of work, is use the American Community Survey, which, as you know, has replaced the census, but allows us to identify people by small geographic area. And we're going to be able to connect those up with the death records by coming up with our own small geographic area that allows counties and these public use micro-analysis areas, the PUMAs that come from the American Community Survey, to be used together in about 1,000 small geographic units in the country.
I see. So innovative, assiduous, and diligent use of governmentally collected data sources.
Yes.
So government has collected data, made available this information at all these levels, and you as a researcher were able to use that. I'm just starting putting it in because, you know, when we talk about what government could do, then what government has done already is created this enormous body of knowledge that is sort of raw material for the work that you've done.
That's right. And that's been incredibly helpful to us. And it's always under threat. Right, because these are expensive. So we go to Washington, we talk to legislators, we show them the kinds of things that one can do with the kinds of data that we collect, because we want to make sure that these are never on the chopping block.
And they're listening?
Some of them, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's I think they can become political footballs, mm-hmm. but they've never been threatened in any serious way yet. Mm-hmm. Not to say they wouldn't be.
And then one last question before we run out of time. At the state and local level, are there kind of any signs of progress that you've seen in addressing this that might not be going on in Washington?
No, but that doesn't mean they're not happening. Uh-huh. It's just that this work, as you can imagine, because it has so many different moving parts, needs to unfold in stages. Mm-hmm. Although I do want to say that when we go out and talk about this work, there's a lot of work to do, mm-hmm. and we'd love to engage other researchers to peel off parts of it and drill into it, because we think that there's just much, much more to be done.
Well, it's really impressive and important and fascinating to see research like this that's had such a big effect on a key conversation that we're having nationally. So congratulations to you for producing this. And it sounds like there's a lot more to come.
There's more to come. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, that wraps up our episode. Thanks to Ann Case, a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University, for joining us to discuss her recent work. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.